Chapter 17. Country Killings. In her fascinating study, Murder and Its Motives, the British writer F. Tennyson Jesse lists the half-dozen commonest reasons for murder. Money, revenge, jealousy, sadism, elimination, and conviction, in other words, political murder. However, she has missed out one of the most important. Boredom, which is often the ultimate cause rather than the immediate motive for certain killings. Why did William Calder kill Maria Martin and bury her body in the Red Barn? Because he was bored with her. Why did he get involved with her in the first place? Because he was bored with his dull life in the wilds of the English countryside. This despairing action is a basic recurring pattern in country-style murders. The dullness leads to boredom. The boredom leads to sex, and the sex can lead to anything, from women tearing one another's hair out on the village green to a corpse in a ditch. Sophisticated city dwellers can hardly realise how much sex goes on in country areas, how much wife-swapping and husband-swapping, and even more dubious practices. A horrifying example of this occurred in Cornwall in the St Austell area, when the body of a 10-year-old schoolgirl was found in 1969. Signs of sexual molestation led to alarm in the area and fear of a sex maniac. But a few days later, the victim's stepfather was arrested and charged with the murder, and at his trial it was revealed that he had been her lover for years. The city newspapers take care not to print the details of such cases, and of dozens of others involving incest, rape and bestiality that are horribly familiar to every circuit judge in remote country areas. The fact appears to be that when human beings have nothing else to think about, their thoughts turn to sex. And that is the key to the great majority of murders in rural areas. In many such murders, the details are so commonplace that they can only be found in local newspapers of the period. For example, the Maria Martin situation, a pregnant girl murdered by a lover who wants to avoid marrying her, has occurred dozens of times in the annals of crime in England alone. One such is recorded in the Newgate Calendar. It took place in 1700 in Lichfield in Staffordshire, which in those days was little more than a country village. Elizabeth Price had already been seduced by an army officer and had borne a child when she met Dr. George Cadell, a surgeon and a widower. A pregnancy was shortly the consequence of their intimacy, says the Newgate Calendar, primly. The girl pressed for marriage, but Dr. Cadell had meanwhile become engaged to the daughter of a professional colleague. One Saturday afternoon, they went for a long walk in the fields. Then they sat under a hedge, and Cadell produced a knife and cut her throat. He was so shocked and confused at the time that he left his case of instruments by the body, so when she was found the next day, no one had any difficulty in identifying the murderer. The girl's landlady also mentioned that she had left to take a walk with Dr. Cadell. It was an open-and-shut case. Cadell was hanged in July 1700. What's interesting about the case is the way the Newgate Calendar presents it. In the days when it was first published, 1774, all murdered girls were beautiful and, of course, innocent. All murderers were dastardly. It explains that Cadell intended to murder Elizabeth Price before he met her that Saturday afternoon. It does not explain why, in that case, he spent the whole afternoon walking around with her before finally cutting her throat, or why a premeditated murder should have been bungled so absurdly. But it offers enough facts to suggest the truth about the case. It admits that innocent Miss Price threatened to expose Dr. Cadell if he refused to marry her. What seems likely is that Cadell met her to try to persuade her to leave him alone or to submit to an abortion. When she refused, he probably lost his temper, seized a surgical knife and cut her throat. There's no evidence that he premeditated the crime, but there is a suggestion that Miss Price had a vengeful side to her nature, which could have led him to lose his temper and to kill her. The Newgate Calendar concludes, "From this story, the young officers of our army may learn a useful lesson. For if Miss Price had not been debauched by one of that profession, the fatal catastrophe had never happened." Presumably every officer who read this made up his mind never to seduce another country girl again. One of the most puzzling rape murders of the 19th century is remembered today only because it raised a peculiar point of law and led to the abolition of a statute that dated back to Anglo-Saxon times. On the morning of May the 27th, 1817, a man climbed over a stile near the hamlet of Erdington, which was near Birmingham, and saw a bonnet, a folded dress, and a pair of ladies' shoes lying near a pond. On the damp grass nearby, there were definite signs that two people had been running. the pond was dragged, which brought to light the fully clothed body of a 20-year-old girl, Mary Ashford. Medical examination revealed that she had lost her virginity shortly before death and that she had drowned. On the previous evening, Mary had attended a dance with a friend called Hannah Cox. She had gone to Hannah's in her ordinary clothes, changed into the dance frock there, and then spent most of the evening in constant demand from the local menfolk. The man she danced with most frequently was Abraham Thornton, a farmer's son. Thornton found her desirable. He told a friend that he was going to have her before the night was over. He and Mary left the dance at around midnight, and between then and 4 in the morning, she seems to have been with Thornton. At 4 a.m, she returned to Hannah Cox's and changed back into her ordinary clothes, bundling up the dance frock. She appeared cheerful, and her clothes were still neat and orderly. She left 30 minutes later and was seen by a man who said good morning to her. What happened in the next 1.5 hours is a mystery. By 6 o'clock, she was dead, and she had lost her virginity so violently that her skirt and stockings were covered with blood. The obvious suspect was Thornton, but he behaved like an innocent man. He seemed amazed to hear of her death and said openly, "I was with her till 4 this morning." He also admitted that he had seduced her, with her consent. Nevertheless, he was tried for her murder, and it was soon clear that there was no evidence to convict him. 3 witnesses had seen him on his way home at about 4:30, several miles from the pond where Mary's body was found. The jury took only 6 minutes to find him not guilty. At this point, Mary's brother, as her heir at law, lodged an appeal of murder, a demand that Thornton should be tried a second time, a notion foreign to our modern sense of justice. When the judge asked Thornton whether he was guilty or not guilty, Thornton replied, "Not guilty, and I am ready to defend the same with my body." Now at this, his counsel handed him a pair of buckskin gloves. He put one on his left hand and threw the other on the ground in front of his accuser. He was invoking an even older principle, that of proving his innocence in combat. Mary's brother, William, was prevented from picking up the glove. The case was complicated enough already without a duel in which someone might get killed, and, once again, Thornton was found not guilty. The case is the kind which delights armchair detectives. One solution would be that Mary fell into the pond accidentally. It had a steep bank and was referred to as a pit in the evidence. But if so, surely her dress and shoes would have gone in with her, not have been left neatly at the top of the slope. Another possibility is that Thornton was unsuccessful in seducing her during the 4 hours they spent together, possibly because she was afraid of staining her dance frock, so he waited until she'd changed her clothes and then made another attempt. She fought him, or tried to run away, hence the trampled grass. He raped her and pushed her into the pond. But there is a clear objection to that. The dance frock and the white stockings she wore at the dance were spotted with blood too. Is it possible, then, that she yielded voluntarily to Thornton before changing her dress and was raped by someone else on the way home? Taking into account all the facts, this seems as likely an explanation as any. There is one other possibility, that she removed her dance frock while yielding to Thornton, hence the lack of grass stains on it when she changed at Hannah Cox's. Then, on the way home, she suddenly began to bleed heavily. She placed the dance frock and shoes at the top of the slope and walked down to the pond, intending to wash off the blood before she went home. She slipped and fell in. Now, at first sight, this seems to be the likeliest explanation, although this is one of those baffling cases where no explanation exactly fits. But Mary Ashford's death had one small effect on English law. The appeal of murder and the wager of battle were abolished shortly after Thornton's trial. Throughout the 19th century, the melodrama Maria Martin, or Murder in the Red Barn, played to packed houses all over England. A spoof version of it is still popular. But equally famous was another tearjerker called The Colleen Bawne by Dion Boucicault, based on a now almost forgotten murder case. The Colleen Bawne, it means white girl, was a pretty schoolgirl named Ellie Hanley, who lived in a small village of Ballycahane near Limerick with her uncle, a ropemaker named Connery. Like Maria Martin, 15-year-old Ellie was the belle of the village. Unlike Maria, she had an unblemished reputation. In nearby Ballycahane Castle, actually a farm, lived the local squire, 26-year-old John Scanlan, an ex-army officer who'd fought against Napoleon. Scanlan attempted to seduce her, but Ellie was shy, inexperienced, and a good Roman Catholic. The virtue, however, only seems to have been skin deep, for when Scanlan persuaded her to elope with him and to make an honest woman of her, she decided to take her uncle's life savings, £120. They ran away in June of 1819 and were married by a defrocked priest. Scanlan thought the marriage was not legal. He was shocked to learn shortly afterwards that even a defrocked priest has the power to perform a ceremony of marriage, and that Ellie was therefore his wife. By the time he made this upsetting discovery, he had achieved his object, the taking of Ellie's virginity, and was thoroughly bored with her. His servant, Stephen Sullivan, his old army batman, was equally dismayed. He was entirely in favour of his master seducing a village girl, but he preferred to be the servant of a bachelor. Scanlan had taken Ellie to the village of Glynn on the Shannon for their honeymoon. The village was dull, and after a few days they moved to an island in the river. Both Scanlan and Sullivan wanted to get back to Castle Ballycahane and the dogs and the horses. But how could it be done? Ellie had spent a great deal of the stolen money on silk dresses. Her uncle wouldn't take her back, and besides, she was now in Scanlan's charge. In his boredom and desperation, the former officer and gentleman saw only one way out: to murder her. Sullivan agreed to this solution. One moonlit night, they rowed out onto the river. At a signal from Scanlan, Sullivan raised his club. Ellie thought it was a joke and laughed. Sullivan was so unnerved by this that he dropped the club, and Ellie rowed back home, unaware that she had been so near to death. The next attempt, however, was successful. This time Sullivan was persuaded to do it alone. He drank a bottle of whisky, then took Ellie out for another moonlight row. She fell asleep. Sullivan raised his gun and brought it down with all his force. He missed and hit her shoulder. She woke up, but a few seconds later another blow shattered her skull. Next, Sullivan removed her clothes, with the exception of the bodice, which would take too long to unlace. He tied her knees against her chin, weighted the body with a stone, and threw her overboard. Her body was cast ashore near Glynn 8 weeks later, on September the 6th, 1819. An arm was missing, a leg was broken in several places from Sullivan's frantic blows, and the teeth were also missing. The skull was fleshless, but she could be identified from the large sockets of her prominent incisor teeth. A coroner's jury brought in a verdict of murder against John Scanlan and Stephen Sullivan, and the search for them began. No one seemed to have seen the fugitives since July, but in September someone thought that he had spotted John Scanlan near Ballycahane Castle. Troops surrounded it. A long search failed to reveal Scanlan until a dragoon was about to drive his bayonet into a heap of straw in the barn, when there was a piercing yell and Scanlan leapt to his feet. The famous lawyer Daniel O'Connell was engaged for the defence, and he tried to put the blame entirely on Sullivan, who was still missing. But to no effect. Scanlan was found guilty, and the judge ordered his immediate execution, in case family influence secured a reprieve. As the carriage taking Scanlan to the gallows was about to cross Bull Bridge in Limerick, the horses stopped and refused to go forward. Scanlan had to dismount from the carriage and walk to the gallows on Gallows Green. The crowd saw in this an omen of his innocence, but he was executed all the same. At about the time his master was being hanged, the actual murderer was being married to an heiress in the village of Scarter Glen, 30 miles away. But Sullivan's luck did not hold. The following March he was accused wrongly of passing forged money. In Tralee jail he was recognised and informed upon by a fellow prisoner. Sullivan stood trial in Limerick in July of 1820, in the same dock in which Scanlan had stood. He was also hanged on the same gallows on July the 27th. Before he died, he admitted that he had committed the murder, but he added, "It was Mr. Scanlan who put me up to it." In its time, the Colleen Bourne case achieved even more fame than that of Maria Martin. Not only did it become a play, but Sir Julius Benedict turned it into an opera, The Lily of Killarney, and Gerald Griffin wrote a best-selling novel about it, The Collegians. All these versions emphasised Ellie's beauty and virtue. None of them pointed out that she had stolen her uncle's life savings and spent a large part of it on dresses. It can be seen why, from the criminologist's point of view, most country murders are not of great social interest. The motives usually spring from the banal rural background, and the details are mostly lurid. In cities, the style of murder changes from century to century. In the country, it tends to remain much the same. In 1936, the Scottish crime historian William Roughhead recorded a recent case that may be taken as typical. It happened on the Cuddy's Strip, a lover's lane near Perth in Scotland. In the August of the previous year, a young couple were walking home at dusk in Cuddy's Strip. Suddenly there was a shot. They both turned round. There was another shot, and the boy, Danny Kerrigan, fell to the ground, dying. As his girlfriend, 17-year-old Marjorie Fenwick, bent over him, she found a man standing above her. Small, squat, very powerful. "Stay with him while I go for help," exclaimed Marjorie, and ran back towards the town. The man followed her until they reached a stile, where he threw her on the ground, dragged her into the bushes, stripped and raped her. The rapist had bound the girl's wrists with a handkerchief. Through a laundry mark, the police were able to trace this to a nearby house, which had recently been burgled. The handkerchief had a smell of wood smoke, which led the police to suspect that the assailant was camping somewhere. They quickly located a tent. It was occupied by an Irish tinker, John McGuigan, 24, who was short, swarthy and powerful. He was known locally as a Peeping Tom, and a telescope was found in his tent. McGuigan was soon identified as the burglar who had stolen the handkerchief, among other things, and he had left his fingerprint on a window. At the trial, at which William Rufford was present, the defence claimed that Marjorie Fenwick was lying. McGuigan was cleared of murder but jailed for 10 years for rape. Even though this case was not strictly murder country style, it certainly typifies the kind of rural case in which the element of sexual assault leading to violent death is present. Against this, there have been notable country murders in which the motive was not sexual. There was Ronald Harris, a 24-year-old farm worker, who murdered his aunt and uncle in October of 1953 to take over their farm in Carmarthenshire in Wales. In the same county, a Polish farmer, Michael Onofrasiec, murdered his partner, Stanislav Sikut, and concealed the body so well that it was never found. There was also the famous murder of a cheat and gambler named William Weir by three villains named Turtle, Hunt and Probert in 1823. They lured him to a lonely field and cut his throat and crushed his skull. For some odd reason, this fairly commonplace murder fascinated the British public as much as that of Maria Martin and Ellie Hanley. These exceptions only emphasise the rule that most country murders arise out of sex and boredom, and achieve and maintain their interest by their trappings of lust, rape, self-disgust, and guilt.